The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And with a happy new year to you all, we are reading from the January 12, 2018 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a smiling Donald Trump giving a little fist pump up in the air. And there's a small elephant with his tusk wrapped around one of Mr. Trump's legs, and he's wearing a Make America Great Again baseball cap. The title is Sweet Surrender, Why Mainstream Republicans Are Now Fawning Over President Trump. And with that, we will go right to the main stories and how they were covered. A looming government shutdown. What happened? White House officials were negotiating with congressional leaders from both parties this week to head off a possible government shutdown amid sharp disagreements over spending caps, protections for young undocumented immigrants, and funding for children's health care. Having passed a stopgap measure in December, Congress now has until January 19th to pass a bill keeping the government funded. Republicans will need Democratic votes to pass the spending bill, but concessions to their policy demands could alienate conservative lawmakers. Democrats say they will back a spending bill only if it reinstates the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, DACA, established by former President Obama to exempt from deportation undocumented immigrants who were brought to the country as children. President Trump scrapped the program in September. Congress has until March to decide whether it will be made permanent through legislation. In other key issues, there is bipartisan support, but disagreement over the numbers for lifting spending caps imposed in 2011, refunding the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP or CHIP, and providing disaster relief funds for communities ravaged by hurricanes and wildfires last year. After the battle over funding the government is settled, Republican leaders face decisions on their legislative priorities for the year ahead. House Speaker Paul Ryan said before Christmas he wanted to focus on welfare and entitlement reform, but Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell expressed strong reservations about making unpopular cuts to Medicare, Social Security, and other social programs in an election year. The president, meanwhile, has set his sights on an infrastructure bill to rebuild roads and bridges, saying he really believes the measure could be bipartisan. What the editorial said: Republicans ended 2017 in a mood of undeserved triumph over their fiscally irresponsible tax cuts, said the Washington Post. Even McConnell admitted that the GOP's agenda last year was pretty partisan. The big question in 2018 is whether Republicans will continue trying to govern on behalf of the third of the country furthest to the right, or will leaders chart a better direction? If Republicans and Democrats have any consciences, said the New York Daily News, they will quickly work together to give DACA kids legal status. Over the past year, the 800,000 Dreamers covered by the program have had their hopes raised and then cruelly dashed as Trump first promised they had nothing to worry about and then reneged by rescinding the program so they could be used as hostages over border wall funding. For the Dreamers, this continuing limbo must be torturous. What the columnist said: DACA is definitely the issue most likely to snarl spending negotiations, said Ed Kilgore in NYMag.com. Democrats are willing to trade protection for Dreamers in exchange for increased funding for border control, but not for a border wall. If Trump insists on his wall, a government shutdown is likely. Republicans will get little done this year without bipartisan support, said Carl Hulse in the New York Times. Doug Jones' unexpected win in Alabama has reduced their Senate majority to a razor-thin 51-49, and they want to present themselves as reasonable and responsible legislators going into November's midterms. But GOP lawmakers also cannot afford to alienate their conservative base, whose votes they will need to survive the midterm elections with minimal damage. Likewise, Democrats know that cooperating with Republicans will anger their anti-Trump base. With political risks for both sides, bipartisanship may be an unattainable goal. Democrats have signaled a willingness to work with Trump on infrastructure, said Kimberly Atkins in the Boston Herald. But White House officials say their proposal will involve only $200 billion, not the $1 trillion Trump promised on the campaign trail. A bill that modest would generate little Democratic enthusiasm. With Ryan and McConnell divided over what to prioritize, welfare reform, infrastructure, or even another attempt at Obamacare repeal, the decision is probably Trump's to make, said Russell Berman in TheAtlantic.com. GOP lawmakers learned during the push for tax reform that they could steer policy in their direction by lobbying Trump directly or through appearances on Fox News. The next few weeks will be a battle for the president's ear. And we'll take in a shorter second main story this week. Kim makes peace overtures to South Korea. What happened? North Korean leader Kim Jong-un sought to drive a wedge between the Trump administration and South Korea this week by extending an olive branch to Seoul. In his annual New Year's speech, Kim offered to send a delegation to next month's Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang, South Korea, and proposed to restart inter-Korean talks to ease military tensions. At the same time, Kim warned Washington that he has a nuclear button on his desk and that the entire United States is now in range of North Korean missiles. It's not a mere threat, but a reality, Kim said. The U.S. can never start a war against myself and our nation now. South Korean President Moon Jae-in, who has championed diplomatic engagement with the North, quickly embraced Kim's offer, leading North Korea to reopen a border hotline in the demilitarized zone that had been disabled for 2 years. Negotiators for both sides are set to meet in the DMZ next week to discuss North Korea's participation in the Olympics. President Trump responded to Kim's speech with fury. Will someone from his depleted and food-starved regime please inform him that I too have a nuclear button? Trump tweeted, but it is much bigger and more powerful one than his, and my button works. What the columnist said. President Trump is getting played by Kim, said David Frum in TheAtlantic.com. With each unhinged tweet, Trump gives South Koreans fewer reasons to trust that the U.S. will prevent their country from being plunged into a devastating war, incentivizing the South to placate the North. That's exactly what Kim wants. A rift between South Korea and the U.S., said Margaret Hartman in NYMag.com. Kim may believe that if he improves relations with the South, Seoul will push the U.S. toward détente. At the very least, he'll be able to build a case that the North's nuclear arsenal is a necessary defense against U.S. aggression. Kim's overture looks like a Trojan horse, said Gordon Chang in TheDailyBeast.com. It's no surprise that he's that the regime is changing tactics now that recent United Nations sanctions are starting to bite, with reports trickling out of the north about malnourished soldiers and even rations cut for privileged officials. In the short term, Kim will likely demand aid from the South, but his ultimate goals are even bigger. Break the 7-decades-old U.S.-South Korea alliance. Get 28,500 American troops off the peninsula and intimidate South Koreans into permanently accepting his rule. No one should be afraid to talk, said John Kirby in CNN.com. The initial discussions between the North and the South will be limited in scope, likely centered on logistical details involving two North Korean athletes who have qualified for the Olympics. As for the sparring between Trump and Kim, U.S.-South Korea alliance is bigger than any two personalities, having lasted for 12 presidential administrations. But the fact remains that the Korean Peninsula is closer than it's ever been to nuclear war. All the more reason to find new ways to engage peacefully. Our controversy of the week, Republicans. Is their devil's bargain paying off? Few of us saw this coming, said Rich Lowry in the New York Post. But President Trump's first year in office is actually starting to look like a big win for traditional conservatives. The capstone was the $1.5 trillion tax cut that Trump signed just before Christmas, which lowers the corporate tax rate from 35 to 21%. But the president has also rolled back environmental and business regulations, appointed a slew of young conservative judges, most notably Neil Gorsuch, to the Supreme Court, and withdrawn from the burdensome Paris Climate Accords. Overseas, Trump has pounded ISIS to the brink of defeat, taken a tough line with Iran and North Korea, and finally recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. None of this is to deny Trump's failings. He remains a deeply divisive figure with a shambolic governing style. But from a policy standpoint, it's hard to see how a conventional Republican president could have done much better. For most of 2017, the GOP leadership seemed worried that supporting Trump was a devil's bargain that would end in disaster, said Matt Lewis in the DailyBeast.com. Now, House Speaker Paul Ryan is praising Trump's exquisite leadership. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is congratulating him for a year of extraordinary accomplishment, and an overwrought Senator Orrin Hatch has predicted that Trump will deliver the greatest presidency that we've seen not only in generations, but maybe ever. With Congress's help, Trump did deliver some solid policy wins for the right, said Noah Rothman in CommentaryMagazine.com. But conservatives need to ask themselves, was it all worth it? The president's gleeful stoking of the culture wars over kneeling football players, Confederate monuments, and supposed voter fraud has made the GOP base even more angry and paranoid than it was before. His habit of giving aid and comfort to the worst elements of American society, most notably white supremacists, will surely come back to haunt the GOP in November midterms. Trump is still the cruel, mendacious egomaniac that the Republican leadership used to keep at arm's length, said Connor Friedersdorf at TheAtlantic.com. By fawning over him now, they are disgracing themselves and doing short-sighted violence to the GOP's long-term prospects. This stain won't wash off. Those concerns are well-founded, said David French in NationalReview.com. But the fact remains that so far Trump's impulsive and malicious tendencies have largely found their expression in his Twitter feed rather than in public policy. Despite or perhaps because of their obsequiousness, Republican leaders have succeeded in pushing Trump into a mainstream conservative agenda. The rise of Trumpism was supposed to mean the death of true conservatism, said Ben Shapiro, also in NationalReview.com. Instead, the first year under Trump has left nationalist populists out in the cold, while Trump governs as if he were Ted Cruz. In the end, conservatives will still rule the day, they bowed to Trump, said Brett Stevens in the New York Times. Two central conservative truths are that character counts and culture matters. Yet Republicans are now pretending that Trump's character, his constant lying, his crude bullying, his racial bigotry, his monstrous narcissism, are mere distractions. They are not. Neither is the deep damage being done to our national culture by his anti-intellectual, conspiracy-minded white identity politics. This president has unleashed something deeply ugly, and it won't end with Trump. As decent Americans recoil in disgust, Republicans who embrace this reckless demagogue may end up permanently alienating a generation of young voters. And it is time for our first good week, bad week segment of the new year. Let's see what we have. It was a good week for moving to Mars, parts of which were actually warmer this week than some parts of Canada. In Edmonton and Yellowknife, wind chills made it feel like minus 40, compared with a balmy 9 below in Mars Gale's crater, as measured by NASA's Curiosity rover. It was a good week for turning off some lights when a Pennsylvania woman received an electric bill for $284.4 billion. We had put up Christmas lights, said Mary Horomansky of the erroneous bill, and I wondered if I had put them up wrong. And it was a good week for offshoring, after a group of New Zealanders built a tiny island 100 yards offshore on New Year's Eve to evade a law banning drinking in public. They were trying to claim it was international waters, said the local mayor. But of course, it wasn't. But it was a bad week for novel legal arguments when a court in Pennsylvania rejected a prison inmate's claim that a bag of marijuana found in his rectum did not, in fact, belong to him. It was a bad week for Roy Moore, defeated Senate candidate from Alabama, after the Jewish lawyer whom Moore's wife cited to rebut charges that we don't care for Jews, revealed that he not only voted for Moore's opponent, Doug Jones, but also raised funds for his campaign. There could not be a more passionate supporter of Doug than me, said Richard Jaffe, who once defended Moore's son on drug charges. And it was a bad week for optics when Kathy Gilroy of Illinois, a prominent anti-gambling crusader, won $25,000 playing a sweepstakes game at a local cafe. Gilroy denied any hypocrisy, explaining that the win was God showing his grace on me for her noble fight against gambling. And while we're here, offshore drilling rules on the chopping block. The Trump administration last week proposed rolling back safety regulations for offshore oil and gas drilling that were put in place after the 2010 Deepwater Horizon rig disaster. The Interior Department proposal relaxes the rules on blowout preventers, which seal off undersea oil and gas wells in an accident, and removes a requirement that inspectors confirm that the amount of pressure that drillers propose to use in a new well is safe. The Deepwater Horizon spill happened after a blowout preventer failed when a section of drill pipe buckled, leading to an explosion that killed 11 people. The Interior Department says the proposal reduces unnecessary burdens on the energy industry and will save firms $228 million over 10 years. We're on the briefing page now, titled this week, Jihad's New Home. With ISIS largely defeated in Iraq and Syria, the fight against Islamist terrorism is shifting to Africa. Why Africa? Widespread corruption, poor governance, and large numbers of impoverished young men disillusioned with society have made many parts of Africa fertile breeding grounds for jihadism. The Al-Qaeda affiliate Al-Shabaab has terrorized Somalia and neighboring Kenya for more than a decade. Boko Haram began trying to overthrow the Nigerian government and set up its own small Islamic state back in 2002. In recent years, the African terrorist groups have expanded and become more aggressive. IHS Jane's Terrorism and Insurgency Center recorded 171 Islamist militant attacks in Africa in 2009, resulting in 541 fatalities. In 2015, 730 attacks left 4,600 dead. ISIS's defeat in the Middle East last year exacerbated the problem as thousands of African jihadists started returning home. Tunisia alone accounted for up to 6,500 of the Sunni terrorist group's foreign fighters, more than any other nation in the world. The more we succeed in the Middle East, said Senator Tom Tillis, Republican from North Carolina, the more we are going to see the snakes run to Africa. Where are ISIS militants going? Their main stronghold is Libya, which remains embroiled in a chaotic civil war. The terror group seized the coastal city of Sirte in 2015, its only major outpost outside Syria and Iraq. They were driven out the following year by militias backed by U.S. airstrikes, but have since regrouped in remote rural areas. ISIS's other North African hub is Egypt's largely lawless Sinai Peninsula. An ISIS affiliate called Sinai Province has claimed credit for 800 attacks in the region since 2013 and was widely blamed for the massacre at a Sufi mosque in November, in which more than 300 worshippers were killed. Mokhtar Awad, a research fellow in George Washington University's program on extremism, said ISIS is trying to inflame sectarian strife in Egypt in the hope it will lead to the country's unraveling. Is Al-Qaeda still a force? Increasingly so. While the world's attention has been on ISIS, Al-Qaeda has been seeking to make a comeback, and its leaders are grooming Osama bin Laden's favorite son, Hamza, for a prominent role as an inspirational leader. The terror group's most prominent African affiliate is Al-Shabaab, the former radical youth wing of the Islamist organization that used to control Somalia's capital, Mogadishu. Al-Shabaab carried out the 2013 attack on Nairobi's Westgate Mall and the 2015 massacre at Kenya's Garissa University. It was also blamed for the truck bomb in Mogadishu last October that killed more than 350 people. The group, which enforces a strict Wahhabi version of Islam, no longer controls any major towns or cities. It was ousted from Mogadishu in 2011 by an African Union-led offensive, but still has a significant presence in southern rural areas. Al-Qaeda is the Islamic Maghreb, which mainly operates in Algeria and Mali. It is the group's most profitable branch. Since 2003, it has made $100 million through kidnapping, drug smuggling, and extortion. What is the U.S. doing? The Pentagon has about 6,000 troops engaged in security and counterterrorism missions in Africa. Two-thirds are based in Djibouti, home of the continent's only official U.S. military base. Another 800 are in Niger, 400 are in Somalia, and the rest are spread out across 47 other countries. These numbers have risen significantly in recent years. In 2008, U.S. troops carried out 172 missions, training exercises, or other activities in Africa. Last year, they were involved in 3,500. At least 1,700 of the 6,000-strong deployment are special forces and offer them battlefield guidance, whose official role is to advise and assist, train local soldiers, and offer them battlefield guidance. But they take part in a broad range of missions, including retaking enemy territory and capturing terrorist leaders. The Pentagon is also increasing its use of drones for surveillance and for targeting individuals and training camps with airstrikes. The U.S. conducted at least 30 airstrikes in Somalia in 2017, compared with 34 over the previous 8 years. What's the long-term strategy? The Pentagon's primary aim is to prevent an Islamist group from taking control of large swaths of territory, as ISIS did in Iraq and Syria. But this strategy carries risks. Local armies struggle to retain control of areas they recapture from militants. Drone strikes inevitably lead to civilian casualties, which can alienate local populations and serve as recruiting tool for terrorist groups. Above all, there are fears on both sides of the Atlantic that the U.S. could become bogged down in yet another long-term foreign conflict. African governments want a small U.S. footprint, said Brigadier General Donald Bolduc, then head of the U.S. Special Operations Command in Africa last year. They watch what we've done in other places, and it scares the hell out of them. Quite frankly, it scares the hell out of me, too. You end up in a much bigger fight than you'd prefer. Into the columns now, the GOP's health care mistake. Republicans may have just made universal health care a political inevitability, said Paul Waldman. The party's tax bill eliminates the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate, a move President Trump claims will essentially repeal Obamacare. In reality, however, the elimination of the mandate will only chase away healthy middle-class customers from the insurance exchanges, meaning the vast majority of those covered by Obamacare will either qualify for Medicaid or receive sizable subsidies from the government. Neither liberals nor conservatives will be happy, increasing the political pressure to produce a fairer, more coherent system. It is already clear that every Democratic presidential candidate in 2020 will present some kind of universal plan, whether it's Medicare for all or a hybrid system that keeps private insurers. Republicans will cry socialism, but the party's abject failure to provide any credible alternative to Obamacare has destroyed its last remaining shred of credibility on health care. Had Republicans made modest tweaks in the ACA, they might have dampened enthusiasm for major reform and a move to universal coverage. By repealing the individual mandate instead, they have done just enough damage to Obamacare to give Democrats the opening to go much further. From Spain, seceding from the secessionists. Catalan separatists now know what it's like to face a secessionist rebellion, said David Aladante in the Comedio Baquero. In October, they rejoiced when they won an illegal independence referendum and the separatist-dominated Catalan parliament announced that Catalonia would break away from Spain. In retaliation, Madrid began rounding up the secessionist movement's leaders and ordered new elections in the region. A decision that backfired on December 21, when Catalonia's three pro-independence parties together won 70 of the parliament's 135 seats. Yet the pro-Spain party, Ciudadanos, took the most seats of any single party, 37, and much of its support came from Catalonia's two major cities, Barcelona and Tarragona, where large majorities opposed secession. Ciudadanos' success led to the birth of the satirical Free Tabarina movement, which has declared that the two cities belong to the fictitious region of Tabernia and should remain part of Spain. Over the Christmas holidays, social media enthusiasts riffed on the same slogans the pro-independence crowd once used against Spain. Catalonia has ignored Tabernia, they proclaimed, and Tabernians should have the right to decide their future. Ciudadanos leaders intend to keep the prank going to make their point. Why should Barcelona be torn out of Spain against the will of Barcelonans? And an international How They See Us column, Pakistan rages over Trump tweets. Pakistani leaders find U.S. President Donald Trump's outrageous accusations against our nation incomprehensible, said Sanulad Khan and Nadir Grami in Dawn. In his first tweet of the year, Trump bemoaned the fact that the U.S. had foolishly handed Pakistan more than $33 billion in aid over the past 15 years and been rewarded with nothing but lies and deceit. Pakistan has given safe haven to the terrorist we hunt in Afghanistan, he wrote. No more. Pakistani Prime Minister Shahid Khaqan Abbasi quickly summoned the U.S. ambassador in Islamabad for an explanation and convened a National Security Committee meeting of top civilian and military leaders to discuss Pakistan's response. Trump, the committee said, had heartlessly trivialized the huge sacrifices made by Pakistan, including the loss of tens of thousands of lives in the war on terror. Other officials noted that nearly all U.S. aid to Pakistan is merely repayment for expenses incurred by Pakistan's military as it assists the U.S. in Afghanistan, including America's use of Pakistani bases and communications assets. You can thank India for Trump's abrupt evolution on Pakistan, said IndiasFirstPost.com. In his initial phone call as president-elect to Pakistan's then Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, Trump praised Pakistanis and offered to play any role you need me to play to combat terrorism and stabilize Afghanistan. All the bonhomie, though, collapsed in June after Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi visited Washington and whispered in Trump's ear. The U.S. president then charged that Pakistan hadn't done enough to stop jihadists operating from its soil. By August, he was complaining that Pakistan gives safe haven to agents of chaos, violence, and terror. Now he has announced that the U.S. will withhold $255 million in military aid for Pakistan, but Pakistan has an ace or two up its sleeve, said Jyoti Mahota in the Indian Express. The U.S. has some 15,000 troops in Afghanistan, and it needs Pakistani cooperation there. In 2011, after 28 Pakistani soldiers were killed in a U.S. air raid, Pakistan banned NATO trucks from crossing into Afghanistan from its territory for 7 months, until it got an apology. If Islamabad decides to take tough action, the region will likely get even more troubled, and Pakistan will reach out even more to its benefactor and iron brother, China. China is already behind us, said the news. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman said Pakistan had made enormous efforts and sacrifice for the fight against terrorism. Yet we mustn't listen to hyper-nationalist calls to break ties with the U.S. entirely, said the Daily Times in an editorial. America has troops on our western border and is forging close ties with our enemy, India. If Trump is misinformed about our importance to the war on terror, surely our poor diplomacy is partly to blame. Let's stop the bluster and talk. Time for our in-depth article, The Last Word, this week titled, A Scourge That Spares No Family. When I served as vice chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I helped run the most powerful military on earth, said retired Admiral James Winnefield. Yet I couldn't save my son from his addiction to opioids. The last photograph of my son Jonathan was taken at the end of a new student barbecue on the campus green at the University of Denver. It was one of those bittersweet transitional moments. We were feeling the combination of apprehension and optimism that every parent feels when dropping off a kid at college for the first time, which was amplified by the fact that we were coming off a rocky 16 months with our son. We had moved him into his dormitory room only that morning. I remember how sharp he looked in the outfit he had selected, and his eagerness to start class and make new friends. We were happy, relieved, and, knowing what we thought we had overcome, proud. At lunch, I asked Jonathan whether he thought he was ready for the coming school year. Dad, I can handle it as long as I continue my recovery, he said. Everything flows from that. Only 3 days later, Jonathan was found unresponsive in his dormitory room bed, one of several victims of a fentanyl-laden batch of heroin that had spread through Denver area that week. Jonathan grew up as the introverted but creative younger kid in a career Navy officer's family. He was born a week after I returned from my long deployment and lived through two deployments before reaching his fourth birthday. During one six-year stretch, he attended school in five different districts due to military moves. The one constant was his big brother, his best friend, whom he followed around like he was a rock star. I remember him grinning from ear to ear when he was asked to play on his brother's soccer team because it was short one kid. And again, when the two of them learned to ride a bike on the same day. It wouldn't be the last time Jonathan proved himself a quick study. When Jonathan was in the second grade, his teacher called to notify us that he was selling school supplies to his classmates, lending them money with interest. In the fifth grade, he made a perfect score on the Virginia Standards of Learning science test. In the ninth grade, he hit a walk-off single in a baseball tournament. A year later, he pitched seven gritty innings of no-hit ball over two consecutive All-Star games with the help of a curveball that seemed to defy gravity. Jonathan was quiet, but he had a big heart. He helped coach little kids in baseball and laid wreaths at Arlington National Cemetery. He had no enemies, only friends. His baseball coach told us his mind was a gift, and Jonathan was humble, only replying thank you when complimented, never letting anything go to his head. John didn't brag about what he knew or who he knew, the coach said. Jonathan's military lineage extended to a grandfather and great-grandfather who also served in the Navy, and a great-great-grandfather who was a Prussian cavalryman. One of the few times I saw Jonathan beam with genuine pride was when he was given the great-great-grandfather's sword at my retirement ceremony. The moment was deeply meaningful to him because it signaled equal recognition among family. Jonathan had to pedal hard in the shadow of a successful father and a brother now carrying on the tradition of military service. On the surface, Jonathan was a handsome, shy, gentle kid with a warm and disarming demeanor. But underneath that exterior, he struggled with anxiety and depression, which eventually spiraled into addiction with all its sickening complexity. From an early age, Jonathan lacked confidence and self-esteem. He never seemed comfortable in his own skin. Like many of the 40% or more of teenagers who have reportedly suffered from one mental health issue or another, Jonathan started on the road to addiction early. He began by sneaking a bit of alcohol at night in order to bring himself down from the Adderall the doctor had prescribed him, based on a misdiagnosis of attention deficit disorder. By eighth grade, he was beginning to self-medicate with marijuana. Next came Xanax and eventually heroin. We first tried counseling and psychiatry, thinking this was merely a matter of bad friends and worse choices. We figured that he would age out of it and turn away from drugs. Not understanding how addiction progresses, we foolishly hoped, reinforced by his assurances, that every incident would be the last. The incidents worsened after a girlfriend turned away from him and he was disqualified from playing varsity baseball during his senior year due to deteriorating grades. One April night that year, a suicidal gesture and a car accident left him in the hospital and left us with no doubt that we needed to make a radical change. With no available spaces and treatment facilities in Washington, D.C., Jonathan detoxed in Richmond, Virginia, for a week while we frantically searched for an inpatient center. He growled that putting him into treatment was the worst mistake we would ever make, but we stuck with our decision and sent him away to two sequential state-of-the-art treatment programs. According to the treatment professionals with whom he worked, it takes most addicts well over a year of skilled, intense inpatient treatment to even have a chance of recovery, and my son is evidence that not even that amount of time is guaranteed. Effective treatment generally requires a combination of craving-reducing drugs to give recovery a chance, time for the brain to literally recover, counseling for the addict to understand what he or she is going through, mutual support to maintain sobriety, and transition training to prepare for re-entering society. These programs are still terribly expensive. Because the military's TRICARE medical system would not adequately cover treatment, we dug in and spent more than the equivalent of 4 years' tuition at a private college for 15 months of treatment for Jonathan, a sum that would be well beyond the reach of most American families. It wasn't until our exposure to the parent education sessions at Jonathan's first treatment center that we awakened to the full horror of addiction's relentless spiral. Unlike cancer, which can be seen under a microscope, addiction works away at the brain much more covertly, using the brain's own flexibility against it. As Sam Quinones writes in his book, Dreamland, the morphine molecule has evolved somehow to fit key and lock into the receptors that all mammals, especially humans, have in their brains and spines, creating a far more intense euphoria than anything we come by internally. It creates a higher tolerance with use, and Quinones continues, exacts a mighty vengeance when a human dares to stop using it. What starts as relief of physical or mental pain transforms into a desperate need to avoid withdrawal. Treatment was tedious for Jonathan due to long periods of boredom and his discomfort at being required to reach out to others and talk about himself. But he knew he needed help to recover. Over 16 long months, we saw him almost miraculously begin to pull out of the abyss. We were gradually getting our son back. We watched as his brain recovered and he turned back into his old self. He was more communicative. He was happy to see us when we visited, and even led a 12-step Alcoholics Anonymous meeting once a week. In his last few months in treatment, Jonathan sought and earned his EMT qualification. He said he wanted to use it to help others, especially young people, avoid his experience. He was so proud that he had found something he loved to do. Based on his steady progress, we thought Jonathan was ready to re-enter normal life. Together, we decided he would attend the University of Denver, which had granted him a gap year after high school. Thanks in part to a sympathetic admissions counselor, the school agreed to allow him to enter in the fall. The members of his incoming class were required to read J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy over the summer and to write an essay about a person who had had a profound impact upon their life. Jonathan wrote powerfully about encountering a man in the grip of an overdose-induced cardiac arrest in a McDonald's bathroom during the first ride-along of his EMT training. He said the experience had made him realize how precious life is. I never found out his name, he wrote, but the experience had made him see his life in a whole new light. Sadly, the morphine molecule had burrowed deeper into his brain than we understood. Even as he was writing his moving essay, referring to himself as a former addict, his relapse was already 1 week old. Such is the Jekyll and Hyde nature of the disease addiction. During the weekend before we dropped off Jonathan at college, we missed the telltale sign of relapse. We were blinded by our own optimism. Scientists who study addiction understand how little the disease needs to return at full strength. Even brief flashing images of drug paraphernalia are sufficient to trigger a flood of dopamine in the recovering brain, which can, in turn, cause a relapse. The addict is all the more vulnerable when access to drugs is easy. The location where Jonathan, 2 weeks away from entering college, was taking a nighttime electrocardiogram course is close to one of Denver's open-air heroin markets. He told one of his friends back home that he had been offered heroin while walking back to where he was staying, but had refused. This encounter likely provided the stimulus for his relapse and eventual overdose. Instead of allowing these open-air markets to thrive, we would do well to develop safe use zones like those in Portugal and parts of British Columbia. These areas not only dramatically reduce opioid overdoses, because trained users of the overdose-reversing drug naloxone can be right on the scene, they can offer treatment to addicts who are ready to seek help. Drug overdose, like the one that took Jonathan from us, is now the leading cause of death for Americans younger than 50. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports that more than 64,000 Americans lost their life to a drug overdose in 2016, including 15,446 heroin overdoses. The total is more than 20 times the number of Americans killed on 9/11. The cost of the opioid epidemic extend far beyond the loss of life. The White House Council of Economic Advisors just raised its estimate of the epidemic's annual cost from $78.5 billion to a whopping $504 billion. Princeton University's Alan Krueger recently completed a study suggesting that 20% of the reduction in male participation in our workforce is due to opioid use, and that nearly one-third of prime working-age men who are not in the labor force are taking prescription pain medication on a daily basis. I sit on the board of a medium-sized industrial company in America's heartland that has had trouble recruiting employees despite being willing to hire anyone who walks in the door who can pass a drug test. If America is going to reverse this epidemic, we need to start treating it like the national emergency it really is. We need a call to arms like the one that led to our nation's dramatic decrease in smoking, or to the effective Mothers Against Drunk Driving movement. There are reasons to hope that public awareness of the opioid epidemic is finally beginning to catch up with the facts on the ground. But its defeat will be possible only through a concerted effort that includes full-spectrum prevention, stronger prescription drug controls, more robust law enforcement, and far more access to quality treatment. All of this will require, in turn, major increases in public resources. The final sentence of Jonathan's University of Denver freshman essay reads, "I now live my life with a newfound purpose, wanting to help those who cannot help themselves." Jonathan was very serious about his recovery. He wanted to live and was on an upward trajectory with brand new hopes and dreams. He fought honorably against the demons of this disease, but as with so many others, he lost his battle. Losing Jonathan has left us heartbroken, but we are determined to carry his purpose forward. If his story leads to one less heartbroken family, it will have been worth sharing. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in theatlantic.com. And we'll read one of the obituaries for you this week. The Hollywood veteran who never retired. Rose Marie, 1923 to 2017. Rose Marie was an entertainer for life, considered by many to be the longest working entertainer in show business. The raspy-voiced actress, singer, and comedian was a child star in the golden age of radio and a hit on social media in the 21st century. But it was television that made Rose Marie a household name, thanks to her role as wisecracking TV comedy writer Sally Rogers on the hit 1960s sitcom The Dick Van Dyke Show. The joke was that Rogers was always on the hunt for a husband, but Rose Marie also played her as witty, independent, and holding her own in a field dominated by men. I've had young girls come up to me and say, "It was because of you I became a writer," Marie said in 2004. "I was the first women's liber on television." Raised in a New York City tenement, Rose Marie Mazzetta won a talent contest at age 3 and was soon singing professionally under the name Baby Rose Marie, said the Los Angeles Times. The NBC radio network signed her to a 7-year contract, and her father, who was not married to her mother because he already had a wife and children, became her manager. Most of her early earnings went to support her father's other family or were gambled away by him. Rose Marie's initial success was met with some skepticism, said the New York Times. Many listeners refused to believe that a child could possess such a mature, bluesy voice. So NBC organized a national tour to prove that she was actually a young girl. After high school, she worked as a singer and comedian in top nightclubs, billed as just plain Rose Marie, and appeared on Broadway in Phil Silver's musical Top Banana in 1951. In the 1950s, Rose Marie moved to Los Angeles and began the most famed chapter of her career, a pivot to television, said Vulture.com. She appeared in all 5 seasons of The Dick Van Dyke Show and earned 3 Emmy nominations for her work. She never left the public eye, becoming a frequent guest on the Hollywood Squares game show and appearing on sitcoms such as The Doris Day Show and Murphy Brown. An avid Twitter user with more than 125,000 followers, she recently used the platform to show support for women speaking up about sexual harassment in Hollywood. "I have suffered my whole life for that," she said. "Don't stop." And we've just time left for some of the shorter notes. Let's see. In an impromptu half-hour interview President Trump gave on to the New York Times on December 28th, he made 24 false, misleading, or dubious claims, a rate of one every 75 seconds. Among them, "I am the one that saved coal," and "I think it's been proven that there is no collusion." In 2017, fact checkers found Trump made 1,950 false or misleading claims. The new year brought minimum wage increases in 18 states and almost two dozen municipalities. Those include Arizona, where the pay floor initially rose 50 cents on January 1st as part of a four-year process to boost base salaries for non-tipped workers to $12 an hour. In Washington, where the minimum wage will rise to $11.50 an hour this year and to $13.50 an hour by 2020. The federal minimum wage is currently $7.25 an hour. The year 2017 was the safest on record for airline passengers, without a single commercial jet crashing in passenger service anywhere in the world. The chances of a commercial plane being involved in a fatal accident are now 1 in 16 million, according to an aviation consultancy, 270. And we'll finish with a quote from H.L. Mencken. "What ails the truth is that it is mainly uncomfortable and often dull. The human mind seeks something more amusing, more caressing." And we've run out of time for today's program. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138. So long until next time.